Hello, friend. We had a little bit of a recording problem with the software, so I'm going to re-record this evening's lesson just sitting here at the desk. So we've been talking about chastity and avarice. Chastity is making our decisions or expending our energies with reference to the long-term well-being of the whole, the long-term well-being of me and my partner and the family, the society, even the whole earth. And avarice, then, is making our decisions or expending our energies with reference to a much more limited perspective, and that is just what I want and when I want it. That's what we've been talking about during this lesson series. So that would mean, then, that the prerequisite for chastity is being able to figure out what will work for the long-term well-being of the whole. A prerequisite for chastity, and then, would be discerning wisdom. And while this isn't always the case, a good starting place to figure out what does work and what does work for the long-term well-being of the whole, what does breed wisdom, is the practices and the norms that have stood the test of time, the ancient ways, the ancient truths. So tonight, I want to address two questions that came in. They're not connected to one another, but I'm going to try and connect them together. And for each, we'll go back in time and look at the wisdom that comes from the ages. We'll go all the way back about 1,800 years. So the first question is this, is masturbation a sin? And then the second question is, when and how should I teach my kids about sex? So I want to begin with the first question, of course, then we'll end with the second. So now, as we have discussed here at the church many times, the word, the concept of sin has tended toward distortion through the generations. It has tended to devolve. We've tended to reduce sin down to a list of bad actions, lying, cheating, stealing, fornicating. And the implication is that God is out there somewhere watching, holding up the list, checking it twice, and surveilling us and finding out if we're naughty or if we're being nice. And, Johnny is masturbating over there. I guess that's on the naughty list. That must be a sin. So he's in big trouble, and so we're going to whack him, give him an F on his English paper, or we're just going to put it in the ledger and whack him in the afterlife. And that, we've said so many times, is just a bad, bad way to think about sin. It is a tragic reduction reduces us to misbehaving children in the cosmos and God to an authoritarian punishing parent. Sin is a problem. It's a real problem, but it isn't that kind of problem. It's a problem of false self. It's a problem of not knowing who we truly are, at being alienated from, dissociated from our true center, divine center selves. It's a problem of toxic instincts that come out of that dissociation or that dislocation. But again, I've spoken at length on that point. So it's important to see that the question itself, is masturbation a sin, has embedded into it some problems around the concept of sin. And this isn't the question asker's issue. This is really the Christian church's issue. We often reduce the spiritual life to a list of bad behaviors, and we stay out of trouble with God, and to keep from getting whacked, we just avoid those behaviors or try really hard to avoid them. Well, because I've done so much background in those other places, let me just shorthand it for tonight and say this. Grace is bigger than sin. Consequently, sin is not as big a deal. Forgiveness is the big deal. So if that's the case, then let's reframe the question and ask this. Is masturbation healthy or is it unhealthy? Is it helpful or is it unhelpful? And to answer that question, we have to start with how it got on what we perceived as a list of bad behaviors in the first place. How did it make it on the naughty list? And to think about that, let's go back to the Song of Songs, one of the earliest texts that we have. It's somewhere in the middle of your Bible if you're looking for it. It is part of the Hebrew wisdom literature, and like most Hebrew scriptures, the song has a very comfortable relationship with eroticism. It has a very comfortable relationship with sexuality. It's an erotic poem about the love of a young man for a young woman. He longs for her company and for her companionship. He also admires her body and her beauty. He longs for her touch. He marvels at the beauty of her face and of her eyes, her neck, her breasts. And he's enthralled by this beautiful physical form that she has. And in verse, in beautiful verse, he speaks of his deep longing desire to experience her fully. He wants to enter into the kind of relationship with her that would allow him to go all the way to the deepest intimacy two people can experience, the intimate, relational, physical, and erotic. And the poetry gets pretty graphic along the way. I remember in one of my Old Testament classes in seminary, the professor was taking us through the text line by line, and one line stood out, and it was a euphemistic list, a line about the young man's anticipation of the smell of her garden. That was the phrase that was used. And the professor said, based on this and that, and this interpretation and that interpretation, this is really a reference to his anticipation to the smell of her arousal. There is a scent associated with a sexually aroused woman, and this young man can't wait to experience that scent and all the pleasures that go with it. So, right there in our scriptures is a celebration of deep human physical eroticism, erotic longing, erotic yearning, the deepest physical pleasure, the deepest relational longing. But if you had grown up in the church that I grew up in the years that I grew up in it, here's what you would have heard about the Song of Songs. The whole book is one big allegory. It's one big metaphor. And in this allegory, the young man, well, that's a god. And the young woman, well, that's the church. And it's a poem about God's longing for the church. Gone was anything about the erotic. Gone was anything about sexiness or sensualness. And its place was something apocalyptic. Sometime at the end of time, not having anything to do with sexiness, the day is coming in the distant future, the book is saying, when God will consummate our deepest desires and we will attend the wedding feast of the Lamb and we will be up in heaven at the end of time and we'll be living in disembodied purity, no bodies to get in the way, no physicality to get in the way. And so what was a celebration of eroticism and of physicality and of sexual yearning became something disembodied and non-sexual and ethereal. And so the question then is, how did that happen? Why did this happen? And the answer to that question informs why so many good Christian people wonder if masturbation is a sin or a host of other sexual issues are sins. This is another area I've done whole lessons about, and so just a quick shorthand review. In the second century, Neoplatonic thought, Gnostic worldview thought, got inserted into the Western and into the Christian belief system. It became deeply embedded instinct that the material world is bad and that the non-material, the heavenly, the non-physical world is good. Spirit is good, flesh is bad. And that insertion did not only affect our view of sex and eroticism, it also affected how we think about treating the planet. Often, Christian disregard for environmentalism is rooted in Gnosticism. It's affected how we have thought about imperialism in the past or colonialism. It has had a profoundly influential distortion of a lot of Western history. It didn't just distort our thinking about sex and eroticism, but it surely did distort our thinking about them. So after that distortion happened, we've been on a pendulum swing back and forth. We go from hyper-prudish, as in the Victorian area, to swinging like a pendulum all the way to the other side, to hyper-abandoning of all the truths that we know about sexuality and humanity. And so, after the distortion, as a church, we had to rewrite the Song of Songs. Eroticism just couldn't be in the Bible, could it? So no, of course not. So, sexual yearning that we have for one another, it had to be something else. It had to be something better because sexuality is clearly bad. Well, I remember a minister teaching me when I was young about masturbation, and he said this, masturbation is a sin. Clearly, definitively, it's a sin. It is definitely on God's naughty list. So, it is true, the minister said, that the Bible doesn't say much about it, and here this scripture says this, but that's not really about that. So, we don't really know it's a sin because it says it's a sin in the Bible. We know it's a sin because every young boy who masturbates feels guilty about it. That's how we know that masturbation is a sin. Well, I hope my kids never feel guilty about masturbation, but if they were to have felt it, and if every young boy does feel guilty about masturbation, it's not because it's a sin. It's because of Gnosticism. It's because of Neoplatonic insertion into Western thought and spirituality. It has nothing to do with the Bible. It has nothing to do with God. It has to do with this historical anomaly that has set us on this pendulum path. So, let's talk about masturbation. And to do it, I'm just going to be really practical. In the last few weeks in the discussions, people have asked me to be more practical. So I'm going to tell you how I taught my children about masturbation. And I'm heavily weighting this toward my two boys, how I taught them. Now, I also had a more nuanced discussion with my daughter, and it went slightly differently. It had less urgency about it than I think it had with the boys. But so I will talk to you about it. But this is weighted heavily toward the boys. So what I said to them is, there is in you, or more likely, there will soon be in you, because I started when they were really young, there will soon be in you a very powerful fire, and it's a sexy fire. And you're going to start to awaken to that fire in a few years, and you're going to want to see, and you're going to want to touch, and you're going to want to be with, and you're going to want to feel girls. And it's a really cool thing, and you're going to like it. Right now, you think that girls have cooties, but the day is coming when you're going to want a case of those cooties more than you're going to want to watch SpongeBob. So, however, and then I begin to teach them all the stuff that we've discussed in these last few weeks about the relational context into which that sexuality fits. But then I said, here's the trouble you're going to face. You're going to want that closest kind of closeness that there is, that erotic, physical closeness, and you're going to want it really badly. But because it works inside of relationship like I've taught you, and it doesn't work outside of relationship, and because you're not going to be ready for a relationship for a while yet, this is going to be one of those soon but not yet situations. Soon but not yet. There are some prerequisites, some relational prerequisites, some life prerequisites that you're going to need to get in place before you're going to be ready for this kind of intimacy. And so in our family, I spent years talking to them about the relational context into which sexuality fits. We talked about dealing with that fire carefully. We talked a lot about looking at young women's eyes, not just their boobs. One of the more effective conversations I ever had was when I shocked them by saying that their sister has a nice piece of ass. And I was really glad at how offended they got when I said that. But then I went on to talk about how every girl is somebody's sister. Every girl is somebody's haven. So if we reduce them to tits, if we reduce them to a piece, what a distortion that is of the young woman. And what a distortion and a reduction that is of our own souls. And I talked about how happy it makes us over the long run when we settle for just a piece. And we had those talks, and we had them graphically, and we had them directly. And then I said, but boys, thank God there is a way to keep the fire from burning you up, and that is masturbation. And we spoke quite frankly about how to masturbate, and about why to masturbate, and how why not to masturbate, how often to masturbate, all those kinds of topics. We spoke about them very directly. And we spoke about the benefits, and about the shortcomings. And I said to them basically this, masturbation is like food rations during hard times. If you're stranded in a snowstorm, I remember saying to one of the boys, and you cannot get delicious food, if you can't get cooked food or warm food or tasty, savory food, because those things aren't available, in that situation, you will be happy, happy, happy if you can find any food. And I said, masturbation is like that. It's any food. It's not the food you want. I told them about a fast that I'd been on when I was young, and I was on the third day of the fast, and I was reading a book. It was one of C.S. Lewis' books, I think, and one of the characters was complaining about turnip soup, because the only food that he had available was turnip soup. And sitting there 3 days into that fast, I was just loved some turnip soup. My mouth started watering reading about turnip soup. And I said to my boys, masturbation is like that. While you're waiting for the kind of relationship in which you can experience your deepest sexual desires, you can have turnip soup, maybe some crackers. It won't be the most satisfying thing. It won't be the thing that you really want, but it will keep you going. It will keep you alive. It'll keep you from exploding. Now, I did say, now, there are some pitfalls associated with masturbation as well. And that is, you might be tempted to settle for turnip soup and crackers. You might be tempted to let masturbation crowd out your inner drive to push for the kind of relationship you really want. Because masturbation is easy. You don't have to deal with another person, another human being. You don't have to solve all the relational dynamics. You can just take care of this pressing sexual desire without any access or any reference to another person. And that can become a problem because it can make you settle. It can lure you into not pushing for a deep relationship, not searching for a deep relationship, not scouring the earth looking for the woman that you want. And I said, you just don't want to settle for emergency rations and make that the whole story. I said, the second thing you might be tempted to do is to depend on masturbation to help you deal with non-sexual troubles in your life. I told them, masturbation feels good. Consequently, it releases chemicals in our brains that will fuel a strong motivation drive. The same thing happens with food. The same thing happens with a warm fire. The same thing happens with reading a good book or watching a television show. But anytime we release those feel-good chemicals, we run a risk. And that is that we can use whatever it was that released those chemicals, and in this case, masturbation, not to ease a consuming sexual desire, but to get a little bit of feel-good to help us avoid having to deal with whatever the feel-bad thing is that life is dealing to us. In this case, I said, masturbation could become a strategy for hiding from your troubles instead of dealing with your troubles. People can actually get addicted to masturbation like they can to any other of the dopamine-releasing experiences we have in our lives. So, I said, you got to avoid those pitfalls. These are troubles that masturbation can create in your life. Masturbation can be like emergency rations when you don't have the food that you really want, and that can be quite a beautiful thing. And now, my boys are in their sexually mature but not ready for relationship years, and I ask them all the time, how are you doing with that sexual fire in your life? And they both have, on separate occasions, thanked me. And they've thanked me about those conversations about masturbation. And they've said, you know, it's not what I most deeply want. I want a woman. And I want a relationship. And I want to have the relational context into which to put my sexuality. But I know that's not yet. Right now, I want to travel the world. I want to go climb rocks in Chile. I want to go off to college. I want to see things. I want to get ready for life. So until I'm ready for the commitment, they've said, emergency rations are doing the trick. I can go a while on turnip soup and crackers. And as a father, I relax a bit because it is a concern for parents because so many people make such horrible mistakes in their lives with misused sexuality. But I do feel like I've given my boys an important tool to set them up to channel their erotic desires in a healthy and noble and good way. Now, the second question that came in this way. And I hope you'll see how the background thinking that we had about talking about masturbation will be helpful for this question as well. And the question was this: how young should I begin speaking to my kids about sex? They're right now 6 and 8. Is it time yet? Some of their classmates are talking about sex, so when should I start talking about it? And here's the quick answer. And again, I'm just being practical. I'm giving you my own life experience from raising my own kids. And I would say start speaking to your kids about sex about the same time and at the same depth you start speaking to them about nutrition. When kids are 3 years old, you're already talking to them about candy and vegetables. You're already talking to them about too much candy creates a tummy ache. And now, you're not giving them a whole symposium on the importance of amino acids, but you're giving them the basic picture. And I think we begin to give the basic picture to our kids about sexuality about the same time and at about the same depth. So let's go back to what we said about the last question. If we step back from the pendulum swinging craziness that began 1800 years ago in Western society, if we want to return to a healthy view of sexuality, a good place to go is back to our Hebrew scriptures. And in our Hebrew scriptures and in our Hebrew traditions, we talk to our children about sex with about the same level of weirdness that we talk to them about food. It is a normal part of life. It is a matter of course part of life. Now, here's a good question about the Bible and the Hebrew worldview and sexuality. How did the young man in the Song of Songs, how did he know that there was a scent associated with an aroused woman? How did he know that? He was a young, single man. He'd never been with a woman, and yet he knew. How did he know? In our Hebrew tradition, before Neoplatonism, before Gnosticism, we treated sexuality as an integrated part of our lives. In our Hebrew worldview, we knew that God had made all of creation and said, it is good, it is good, it is good. Which means then that sexuality and erotic desire are good. And this being the case, it was part of our Hebrew tradition to celebrate that sexuality. We didn't hide away from it. We didn't get embarrassed in front of our kids about it. We honored it. We respected it. We toasted it. And we talked together about it. We gave wisdom to our children as a matter of course. Now, the Hebrew tradition also had very clear guidelines about how to teach society and young people about the use of their sexuality. This is what works and this is what doesn't. This is when it works and this is when it doesn't work. Do this at this time and wait until that time to do that. And even if your passions get out of bounds and even if you make a mistake, make it right, and here's the way you make it right. There was clear instruction about how to use their sexuality, but it wasn't dirty and it wasn't hidden away. And the whole premise was, we are going to stand with you as a multi-generational community, as a family, as people who have been where you are today, young person. And we are actually going to fan the flames of your sexual desire. We're going to tell you about the scent of an aroused woman. And we're going to have you anticipate that and look forward to it and celebrate it and enjoy it. And we know that burning desire inside of you, and we are happy about it, and we will laugh with you about it and celebrate that with you. But we're also going to stand between you and the object of your affection, and we're going to say, not yet, not yet, not yet. Soon, but not yet. And then when the day comes, when we say now, and this was something that one of my Jewish friends told me about, the ancient tradition, you and your beloved can go upstairs to consummate your relationship, and we will, our kids included, stay downstairs and have a party. When you think, when you're all finished, you come out and we will cheer for you and we will love you and we will love life together and we will celebrate the beauty of life and the beauty of passion and the beauty of eroticism and we will celebrate the relational context into which they best fit. So they made sexuality a celebration, not hidden away like a dirty little secret. It was out there, it was spoken about, it was modeled, and it was done in the context of a multi-generational community, people who knew the fiery passion of unconsummated desire, but also people who knew the pragmatic dimensions of love that would last a lifetime. And in that context, both were celebrated, and both were honored. So, when family and when community doesn't make sexual training part of the life curriculum for our young people, the children have no option but to figure it out on their own. They have to, because the fire inside is too strong. It will not be dealt with. So we start young. We start talking to our kids about sex when we start talking to them about brushing our teeth. When we start talking about too many cookies and tummy aches. We tell our children where babies come from as soon as they ask. And we don't shade the truth. We tell them how it works. We wouldn't not tell them where their food comes from. If sex hadn't been so corrupted by this Neoplatonic ideology, we'd treat it as normally as we do taking a bath or tying your shoes or, you know, making your bed. So if that's uncomfortable for you, if you're not used to that kind of thing, then get a book. There are several of them out there. I looked up the title of the book that Denise and I used. It's a series that has something for preschool, something for, I think, 5 to 7 year olds and something 10 to 12 year olds pre-puberty stage. And while I was looking, I found an even better book. I thought it's better research. It's called It's Not the Stork. And it looked like it was very well researched. It was age appropriate. And there's a series of them, everything from preschool all the way to just before their adolescence. So read those books to your kids the same way that you read Goodnight Moon to your kids. Start young and be frank. Normalize sexuality so that you can have the conversation without weirdness. Because if you have it with weirdness, they will know that it's weird. And if you have to have weirdness, joke about the weirdness and say, you know, grandma didn't teach me this very well, so I'm a little embarrassed, but I'm going to teach it to you so we're not embarrassed. Normalize it so you can celebrate your own children's eroticism with them as they grow and as they mature. Normalize it so that you can be talking about it in middle school when it really starts to kick in as they do reach into puberty. Normalize it so that when it's time, you can be there to give them the broader picture, the been there and seen the other side picture. And then read. If this kind of stuff isn't intuitive for you, read a book. If you're uncomfortable talking with your teenagers about sex, read a book called How to Talk to Your Teenagers About Sex. Figure out how to speak about it. Have conversations with your other friends who are parents, how they're talking to their kids about sex. Make sure that the conversation is on the table and you're having it with your kids. People screw up their lives with sex all the time. And as I said last Sunday, when they do, they don't just screw up their sexuality, they screw up society. Because how we handle our genitals extends way beyond our genitals. It has to do with the economics of our nation. It has to do with governmental policy. If you trace the Enron crisis, or if you trace the meltdown, the TARP meltdown with the banks, all the way back to the core, a lot of it has to do with what we did and did not do with our genitals. So social fabric is affected by how we handle our genitals as a society. And this is not just true of society, it's true of your own children's lives. What they do with their genitalia influences what they do with their lives. If they don't learn patience, or if they don't learn long-suffering, or if they don't learn how to handle difficulties, or they don't learn how to not have immediate gratification, any one of the things that we learn directing and thinking about and talking about our sexuality then transfers into directing and thinking and talking about our lives. And if we don't help them shape that deep part of their lives, if we are not the voice of wisdom in their lives on the topic, we leave them to get their wisdom from what we've already seen is a highly unchaste society. And that is just not going well. Not going well for our society, not going well for the younger generation. It's not going well for our children. So stand up against Neoplatonic craziness. Stand up against the pendulum swing that has gone from one side of hyper-Puritanism, hyper-non-sexuality or hyper-sexual suppression, all the way over to swing on the other side of paying no attention to the wisdom and the prudence of how relationships work. Stand against the craziness of the pendulum. Stand against our everybody screws everybody response that's going on in our culture today, and teach your children how things have gone so historically wrong and how they can get it right. Learn from the wisdom of the ages and be a voice of that wisdom to our children. All right, my friends. God bless you.